Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming out tonight. My name is Kyle Cunningham. I'm the interim general manager at 91.5 KRCC, and myself and the rest of the myself and the rest of the staff are very excited to be bringing you this event tonight. But before we get started, some thank yous are in order. So first of all, I'd like to thank Elise Jones, Kaya Swanson, Roland Clements, and the rest of the Library 21C staff who have opened up their doors. They've kept the library open later than it normally is tonight for us, and they've just been a pleasure to work with. So please give them a hand. So I'd also like to thank Jeff Beery, Andrew Chalfin, Jake Brownell, Abigail Beckman, Vicki Greger, Carol Sherbarth, and all the rest of the KRCC staff who are here working tonight and who are instrumental in helping organize this event. I don't know if you know this or not, but we have a staff of 12 people at KRCC. So anytime we put something together like this, it's a really an all-hands-on-deck sort of thing. So let's go ahead and give them a round of applause. And finally, I would like to thank all of you who are our members. Without your support, what we do on the air and at events like this would not be possible. So we just thank you so much from the bottom of our hearts for your support, for your dedication, and for showing up tonight. So thank you. Thank you very much. So we have an interesting and we hope entertaining evening ahead of you. We will leave time at the end for audience questions, so I'll be back up after they're done talking this evening. But for now, I'll quit talking and we'll get to our guests. I'd also ask, please, if you can silence your phones. That would be great, so if you haven't done that already. So I'll introduce our guests for tonight. So we have Abigail Beckman. Colorado native Abigail Beckman returned to the Centennial State last year to become 91.5 KRCC's Morning Edition host after spending time at an NPR station in Wichita, Kansas. Like David, our featured guest tonight, she started her journalism career as a newspaper reporter. She's racked up awards for her work, including Murrow's and a Gracie Award, which honors women in the media. Like a proper Coloradan, she loves to hike and she loves her pets. Please welcome Abigail Beckman. Hi. And then the star of the evening, Morning Edition host David Green is an award-winning journalist, Harvard graduate, and an author who started out in newspapers. He's hosted NPR's flagship program since 2012 after spending time in Moscow as a foreign correspondent. Prior to that, he reported from Libya as part of NPR's coverage of the Arab Spring and has crossed continents as a White House correspondent and the United States after elections and natural disasters. Most recently, he spent time out of the host chair reporting on issues from the southern border from El Paso, Texas. Please give a warm Colorado Springs welcome to David Green.
So again, thanks everyone for coming. We're really excited, very excited to have David here today. One thing I wanted to start with, I was curious this morning. I know you hosted Morning Edition from California. I was in this morning and I thought, how is that going to work? So you've landed here at 11 or so?
11:30, nonstop from LA to Colorado Springs. It was okay. Pretty awesome.
So this is a 24-hour day of work.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay. Well, we appreciate that.
We've done those before.
So,
you've done those before.
Yes, we're used to it. So, also, it's kind of interesting, both of us being involved in something in the evening when this is, actually, it's really close to my bedtime.
So. I know this is David.
So if we both nod off, please don't.
Yeah, just be ready.
Don't take it personally.
Yes. So, first to start, I mean, you travel back and forth a lot to Washington, D.C. I know that's where your wife lives. Let's talk a little bit about how the show is organized when you are hosting from L.A. and the rest of your co-hosts are in D.C. How is that kind of orchestrated? How do you guys make that work?
It's kind of a technological, it's something amazing. Because they really have tried to create a sense of us being together, both me with either, you know, Rachel or Steve or Noel. We have a video feed, so I can see the director in Washington on camera, he or she pointing to me to start talking. And, you know, once in a while, if it's someone taller you know, they're suddenly out of the camera shot, and I have to be like, I can't actually see you right now. And then I can see, like this morning, I could see Rachel on camera. I mean, kind of like look at each other. And then there's a red phone that looks honestly like what you would imagine the White House nuclear phone to be. We have one in Washington, one in L.A., and that is funny. It's complicated if I wanted to actually just talk to Rachel, because I would have to say, hey, can you open my mic and Rachel's mic, and so we can actually communicate. So it's just easier. We can pick up this phone, and if I pick it up, it immediately starts like ringing with a red light in Washington, and then we can just talk. And rarely are we saying anything important.
So you do get a bit of the camaraderie.
You
You're
get
still
a bit of the
of
camaraderie,
that.
Yeah. And then, yeah, we just sort of act like we're in the same place, and we're messaging each other, and you know, we have scripts. It can be a challenge if we're covering, you know, a really breaking story totally live, because, you know, if you're in the room, if it were you and I were in the room, like, you know, if you're saying something and then if I had a question to ask a guest or something, like, I could, like, signal you. It's a little harder on camera, so sometimes we're messaged, you know, Rachel will message me and be like, hey, can I jump in and ask the next question of this guest, and we'll do it that way. But normally it's pretty seamless.
Yeah, I wouldn't have known. I mean, I hear you say you're in California and they're in D.C., but it's a pretty impressive process to hear it all.
We sang together this morning.
Yes.
which when you think of the 3,000 miles apart, I thought it was almost coordinated. Rachel was actually on key. You can't, no matter what the distance is, you can't help that. But yeah.
And so your wife lives in D.C.
My wife lives in D.C.
Let's talk about that.
How do you guys manage that when you're, I mean, waking up at midnight to go to work?
Yeah.
And there's still a time difference between the two of you.
It's basically, so she owns two restaurants in Washington, and when we were in the same city, she would work until 1, 2 in the morning sometimes, and I'd be going into work around 3 in the morning, and so we might have a chance to say hi, except I was, like, still groggy from sleeping, and she was exhausted from a day of work.
Sure.
So often we'd be living in the same house and not see each other that often. So we had some pretty serious talks about us, when this LA opportunity happened, because we're both sort of have been in DC for a very long time and want something different. DC can get a little old after a long, long time. You know, she and I talked and we figured, let's try this adventure. Let's do bi-coastal for a couple years. And with the understanding, you know, at NPR that if, you know, I'm certainly not going to hurt my marriage for, I mean, I love NPR, but there are things that are more important than work.
Yes, absolutely. So,
you know, they said, you know, I could always move back to Washington if we're not happy. And it's been 2 years. We do a lot of flying back and forth. You know, I'm going to Washington. I'll be there the next 4 days. She's coming to LA next weekend. And she's thinking about maybe opening a restaurant in LA. So, you know, so far it's, I don't know how long this will last, but it's when you don't see your partner for 5 or 6 days, when we come together, it's almost like it's a first date again. And we're just focusing on each other and not thinking about, like, what friends we want to see or what meetings we have. We're, like, just right there with each other, which you know, feels kind of special.
Yeah, and meeting in fun places.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you're traveling back and forth to D.C. and then wherever you and Rose meet up. You were also recently in El Paso, Texas. I'm sure you all heard David reporting from the border. So this crush of asylum seekers, and this is kind of the surge that President Trump has talked about for closing the border. When you were there, it was right after they had removed a group of migrants from under the bridge with the barbed wire fencing, but they weren't saying where the people had been moved to.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have a clip of your reporting. It's a conversation with you and Stevens, keep talking about what you had seen. So we're going to listen to that clip and then ask some questions.
Well, it looks totally different. I mean, you know, we had been hearing for days now about families with their kids just crammed under that Paso del Norte International Bridge. Some were sleeping on the dirt in these cold nights behind barbed wire. By midday yesterday, they were all moved out. They'd been relocated. Our producer, Danny Hajek, went down and was looking at the area, totally vacant there. You know, he saw garbage just littered on the dirt where families had been sleeping. And, you know, those blankets made of Mylar that look like foil that you know, people get after they go on a marathon run. They have been keeping people warm there. And now you just saw these pieces of
foil caught up in the metal fencing, just really fluttering in the wind quietly.
So people were held under the bridge. The explanation was there was no place else to take them, but now they've been taken somewhere. Where?
I mean, that's the big question. We asked the border authorities to confirm these reports that some of them have been moved to a different holding facility that's really close by, right in the same area there, and they haven't told us anything yet, but they had come under a lot of criticism for the conditions under that bridge. And I got to say, we got here midday yesterday, and it took just one phone call to find a spot where some of the people who were under that bridge had been taken. It was this motel where a shelter organization had rented out some of the rooms, and I saw a van pull up, a Border Patrol agent unlocked this metal door on the back of the van, was guiding migrants, including little boys and girls, out. We watched maybe a dozen or so arriving at this hotel, and I want to play the voice of Suzanne Tilton. She's one of the volunteers there.
When they tell their stories, it is emotionally draining because you feel helpless, like you really can't do much for them other than just help them get to where they're going. We can feed them. We can make them feel loved and comfortable here and safe here. They're safe, they're fed, and they're warm, and we're going to help them reunite with their families.
And Steve, I mean, just one detail, as we were watching these families arrive and seek whatever help they could get. Apparently the border authorities, they take away your shoelaces when you arrive at the border, along with a lot of other your personal belongings. And I saw this one little boy at the hotel who, he had tied his shoes using strips of that Mylar foil from the blankets. And just to see the relief on his face when they handed him new shoelaces, I mean, it was just really powerful.
So a lot of vivid imagery in that clip. I'd be interested, what do you choose to include, and what was that experience like, seeing that little boy with his shoes and, I mean, something so basic as shoelaces, the effect that that could have?
You know, this was such a reminder to me that there's nothing like being there. I mean, and this was a story that I think we were all following from afar, based on headlines, based on pundits, based on, you know, political back and forth, you know, crisis at the border, ICE is being inhumane. I mean, just stuff that we're just, you know, you realize it's just words at some point, you know, important, you know, when people are smart and they know about a situation. I'm not saying their analysis is not important, but, you know, the extent to which I truly understood what was happening by being there was just amazing. And, you know, it's, for all the political back and forth and all the debate about immigration right now, you know, this was a human story that involved people. It involved families who were escaping unimaginable poverty and really frightening violence, who were looking to the United States for just, you know, some sense of hope. It was government officials and people who work for agencies like ICE who, you know, can get a bad rap sometimes, but there are a lot of people who are working for those agencies who feel like they're saving lives and helping people every day, and they're just overwhelmed, and you could see it on their faces. It's residents of El Paso and church organizations who are trying to fill this void and help people in this desperate time, and just to talk to the people who are actually involved and whose lives are just being, you know, thrown in every which way. It was just a reminder to me of how important that is to actually be there. And, you know, that little boy, I mean, his face just said it all. You know, he just wanted something to hold his shoes together. I mean, it's that...
Yeah, something so basic.
It's that simple, yeah. And I mean, there were we talked to people who had done a lot of the trip, you know, with no shoes. And, you know, one of the other powerful moments was a woman who had made the trip from Central America who said that a police officer had given her some clothing. And it wasn't totally clear whether she meant border authorities, like while she was under the bridge, or where exactly, or if it was on the Mexican side. But, you know, I think it's very tempting to make this about, you know, immigrants versus ICE, or, you know, people who are pro-immigrant versus people who are anti-immigrant. And to get caught up in some of those loud, larger debates. And, you know, to just tell the human story, I feel like is when we're doing our job the best.
And how does NPR make the decision to send a host to report? I mean, that's there's correspondence all over the world all the time. What was the decision to send you down there and have you report and host from El Paso?
Yeah, that's something that we're really experimenting with because our international desk is incredible. I was honored to work in Moscow for that desk for several years. You just think of some of the names of correspondents at NPR who have put their lives at risk. Many of them women, which I'm really proud of. I mean, I look up to some of the most talented, just incredible correspondents, people like Julie McCarthy and Lourdes Garcia Navarro and Soraya Sarhadi Nelson. I mean, it's incredible. And so I think that when we as a show think about going somewhere, the first thing that's really important to me is that we're not, trying to overshadow our great correspondents. It's like I want to go to a place where we're actually showcasing and highlighting their work. So we're still sort of trying to figure out when the right moment is to go to a place. And I think it's when we feel like taking the show somewhere helps listeners feel like they are really transporting to that place. And so El Paso, it's a moment where we have been talking and talking and talking about the city being overwhelmed and this overwhelming situation at the border. It just felt like a moment for us as a show to say, let's all together, and I mean, you and all the hosts and me and all of our listeners, let's all go to El Paso together and really feel what this is like right now. And those are the times I think it's important. But it's one of the best part of our coverage, I think, when we were down there was talking to John Burnett, who was, a couple thousand miles south of me, near the border with Guatemala, telling us about how porous that border was, which is kind of where the journey is beginning. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that I don't think you get anywhere else from a news organization. I mean, being able to say, John Burnett is there, this is where that journey begins, I'm in El Paso, this is where this journey is ending, this is what's happening, that's the kind of thing that we do that I feel like, makes us distinct.
And so you were set up in a hotel room to host, is that right? How does that work? How do you move a studio to that?
So we'll try if we can to find a place, if it's outside or sort of in the story, but oftentimes the most reliable place to host is from a hotel room. And what you really have to be careful of is waking up other guests at,
Yeah, I can imagine. and they're like banging on the door.
Yeah, so among the many really wise decisions that the producers on this trip with me made is they went to the hotel and said, do you have anywhere where you could kind of like cluster all of us away from other humans so we're not waking people up?
Yeah.
Because there has been, I've been on live radio in hotel rooms with people banging on the wall. And it's like, I can't start whispering.
Yeah, it doesn't.
I mean, I'm really sorry. I will bring you whatever. I'll bring you a gift afterwards. But, it's not necessarily soundproof. So when we're actually recording pieces in the hotel room, we'll create a pillow tent.
Sure, yeah.
Being...
yeah, I've reported under coats.
Yeah. So it's often a very sweaty experience. The producer, I'll have the script on my phone, and I'll have a colleague who'll stick the microphone through a hole in the comforter, and then we'll put the whole comforter and pillows and everything, and I'll be underneath this.
Yeah.
And I mean, the sweat starts to come down, and at some point, the producer's like, "Can you retract that one line?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure, no problem.
Yeah,
that's great."
Like, yeah. Let's just,
but yeah, that's often it's yeah, it's glamorous.
Yeah. I had a similar experience. I was in Heston, Kansas, reporting. There was a shooting there, and a colleague and I had gone, and I was filing stuff for NPR, and I had this Subaru Outback. And so we were filing from the field, and I would get in the back of the Subaru and lay under my coat and a blanket and record, and she would. And it was the middle of the night, and she would have to get out of the car and come let me out of the trunk.
Needed her.
Yeah, I'm lucky I had her. And we were parked on a side street, and eventually somebody had called the police, and they came. Like, what are you doing?
Did the police come?
Yeah, well, they were there anyway, but they right, yeah, but they were curious about what they were like. We got these two girls over here climbing in and out of the car, so yeah, there's a lot of behind the scenes things, but it all sounds good radio. So you talked to a lot of politicians and people affected by this issue at the border. Why do you think the situation is where it is, as far as it feels a bit like a sort of a stalemate, for lack mm-hmm. of a better term, between political parties in your travels down there and the people you've talked to? Share kind of your thoughts on that.
I mean, there's a real consensus among people like in El Paso, and I'm talking about people who have a lot of different views about immigration, that, you know, our nation's laws right now are just they're flawed. And there's no clarity, and there's never been clarity from Congress or an administration. This goes back years now. I mean, I was covering George W. Bush's administration when it looked incredibly close to a historic immigration agreement between a Republican president and Ted Kennedy, and John McCain was involved, and it fell through at you know, the last second. And that was a time when you had a Republican president who could give a lot of Republicans who felt very important to be incredibly tough on security, gave them, I think, some political cover to, you know, come up with a more moderate deal. And I think Ted Kennedy gave some cover to a lot of Democrats who were worried about the politics of immigration and, you know, got them to be willing to have a more moderate deal. And yeah, I think that's as close as it came. And you know, the different sides in this debate have just grown farther and farther apart. So everyone points to this impossible situation in the law, which sort of led to a lot of the family separation. But, you know, under U.S. law, you can't detain a child for longer than a certain period of time. And so if someone is crossing the border illegally and they're with a child, I mean, the choices are, do you separate adult from child, which is what the Trump administration decided to do for a time, which is what the Bush administration, Obama administration had thought about but decided not to because they felt that it was inhumane. And if you don't separate them, then what do you do? So that's a related situation. This one is people who are coming and surrendering themselves and saying in many cases that they want political asylum in the United States. And the law as currently stands is if you come with a child and you're with your parent, that you can't be detained for a long period of time. And so the normal practice before, when the numbers weren't this high, was that you would have border authorities would turn over families to ICE, who would sort of process and consider the immigration case, and there'd be sort of a step taken to kind of think about where this family was, but the numbers are so overwhelming right now that in many cases, Border Patrol isn't even going through ICE. They're just getting families in, processing them, and getting them a place that will give them help, like some of these relief organizations we visited, and then they're able to go into the United States to find other family members who they can be with, and they're given a court date. And what, you know, what John Burnett revealed to us in his reporting, like down closer to Guatemala, is that word is just spreading, because there's a lot of uncertainty about whether President Trump could shut the border down at any point, and two, because of the process right now, you know, the families are coming in and being allowed to move in the United States with relative ease, and I say ease, I mean, I'm not saying it's easy, obviously, it's a horrific journey, but they're not getting caught up in the U.S. immigration court system, and so people are just, you know, this is the moment, and the numbers are swelling, and it's unclear what the U.S. government can do.
Well, and I remember in your report, you asked, and it was the woman who spoke in the clip, how they verify that the children are actually with a family member when they come. Did she give you any insight into that actual process?
No, and that's something I'd love to explore more, because we were hearing some stories about families being separated because a child was not with his or her parent, and they were kind of terrible. I mean, it was, she told us one story about a child who came across with her aunt, and the child's mom was already in Florida and had asked her sister to bring her child over. And since that wasn't her, you know, legal parent, they separated them at the border, and this child didn't see her mom, you know, for several weeks. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that gives you a sense of how imperfect the system is. But in terms of validating, I'm just not sure. Is it?
Yeah.
It's, you can imagine a lot of cases where there aren't, you know, documents that would prove.
Right. So, with this being your everyday as a journalist, and it's mine too, but more so, I mean, you are on the ground. How do you navigate this political climate as a journalist? Does it feel different than, let's say, 15 years ago? I mean, is it something that you feel weighs heavily on you in the profession?
Oh, it's really pleasant. It's very.
I love it.
It's nice.
It's the best ever.
Nothing but accolades from listeners every day.
Right.
It's just all roses. It's getting really hard. I would tell myself that I'm really thick-skinned, and you know that trolls on social media don't bother me, but you know, if you get, I mean, it's, you know, people just who want something from journalists today. They want us to take a position. They want us to advocate. They want to be angry at someone. They want to blame us. It's a climate right now where there's a lot of anger, and a lot of that is heaped at us, and it gets incredibly personal. And
quickly, too, with social media.
Quickly.
Yeah.
And, I reflected on this yesterday because after Julian Assange was arrested in London, we called Glenn Greenwald, who, you know, is a journalist who's, you know, been involved with Assange and has covered Assange over time. And he's had some pretty critical things to say about NPR, and I sort of knew that we're not his favorite news organization.
Mm-hmm.
He had criticized me in the past for being too impartial.
That's a new one.
Yeah. So I knew what I was getting into, and then went on live with him, and just it got off on the wrong foot. I described him as a colleague of Julian Assange. He immediately said, like, why are you calling me that? I was like, well, I mean, why don't you describe your relationship? And he was like, well, I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. So I was like, glad you took that opportunity to let us know. That's good. who's covered Assange. And then it went downhill from there. I mean, he tried to come at me by saying, like, you know, I don't know if you are the kind of journalist who actually has sources like I do. That's the kind of work I do.
He told you to Google something?
He told me to, he made this charge that the Trump administration had pressured the Ecuadorian government to release Assange, which I knew that had been out there. But when he said it, you know, I wanted to challenge him. I said, well, you know, what is the evidence of that? What's the reporting? And he was basically like, why don't you Google it? I mean, everyone's covered it, including probably NPR, dude. I added dude for effect. But the response after that, like, it's one thing to have an uncomfortable interview with Glenn Greenwald. That's fine. But, I mean, my Twitter account just lit up, and it was just conspiracy theories that we had removed the interview from our website because we didn't want anyone to know what Greenwald had said. He went on Twitter and was like, listen to the lie-filled interview that was on NPR. I'm trying to figure out what lies were in there. And it was just so much anger and people, and it. So this is this hyper-polarized environment, but when it comes to what we do, I think what worries me most is even when our coverage was criticized or when people were suspicious of bias, you know, I look back to the years covering Bush and so forth, there was still this feeling that what we were doing was news. What we were doing was something worthy, that we were playing an important role in society. That, you know, even if we were biased in the eyes of someone, they still accepted that I went to work every day trying to do the best I could to tell a fair and accurate story. And that's just gone. I mean, now it's every time there's a story that someone is not happy about, it's questioning our motives, it's questioning our own beliefs. It's, you know, I mean, just saying nasty stuff. And I really worry that we have lost the definition of what is news. And that troubles me so, so much because, you know, we've got to get it back. And, you know, the idea that people now feel like, you know, you get your news from your social media feed. I mean, you know, I'll say to someone like 20 years ago, if your friend had walked up the street and said, do you know that the mayor just killed someone? I mean, would you have accepted that as fact? I mean, probably not. You would have said to your friend, like, are you drunk? Are you sure? Like,
how do you know that?
Where are you getting this? How do you know that?
Yeah.
And now we trust everything.
Mm-hmm. And the share, just share.
We trust everything share. Or we don't trust everything, and or anywhere in between. But there's no, you know, and I would like to believe that we are this one place that people still feel like they can turn to and get that. I mean, it you know, I grew up admiring people who sat behind an anchor desk, and that anchor desk seemed like it was sacred. Mm-hmm. Like that, if you saw someone behind an anchor desk, that was a person who you could trust to tell the truth. And I mean, you think about the number of people who sit behind anchor desks now, and you don't have an ounce of trust in. And that's really sad.
Well, and that's a good segue into this next clip I have, and this is one that you sent in. It's from an interview in 2016 as part of a project called Divided States. So this project featured conversations with voters across various states. And in this clip, you're speaking with a woman from Tucson. She's a working mom, a real estate broker, and she's one of many supporters of Donald Trump that you talked to for the project. So we'll listen to this one, and then I'll have you respond.
Okay, so more about Eileen Eager. She is from Chicago. At one point, she was a single mom raising two kids, and I asked how tough that was.
Well, tough enough that I occasionally had to go out on a date where I would order a big steak that I didn't even want to eat, and then I'd put it in a bag and take it home for the kids. So that's pretty darn tough. I worked at the steel mills. I was a secretary there. And as a matter of fact, that's where I met my husband.
That was her second husband, and they moved to Tucson, about 60 miles from the Mexican border. He is a Mormon, and so she converted. Now, many Mormons have serious concerns about the fact that Donald Trump has called for a temporary ban on Muslims, but not Eileen.
I'm going to tell you something that maybe you don't know about the Mormons. So at one time when the Mormon Church first began, they would congregate naturally together, just like the Muslim people do. And pretty soon someone would run for a public office. Well, then they would be chased out of that place because of the fact that the local people were concerned about the power of that Mormon group of people. They were chased clear across the country until they came to Utah. So in a way, I understand completely Trump saying he would ban the Muslims from coming here. But do you understand why he says that? Are you a little bit afraid that somebody might walk into your school where your children are because he wants to kill anyone who doesn't believe the same way that he does? See, and that's the difference between the Mormons that were chased and the Muslims. The Mormons wanted to live peaceably amongst the people. The Muslims want to come here and change, many of them, what we're doing. If they believe in the Quran, that's what they want to do. And their goal, many of them, is to kill us.
Now, you say many of them, their goal is to kill. Do you really believe that it's many? Because some have said that, you know, there are very isolated cases of extremist Muslims, but that to suggest it's many would be, you know, basically, you know, discriminating against an entire religion.
Well, I think that we need to look at what's happening in the United States right now. These bombings and shootings that we are seeing, it's these radical Islamists that are coming in, and they are trying to frighten us, and it's a plan that has been in place for 10 years or longer. It's a caliphate.
So she clearly holds a radical and demonstrably false view of Muslims and Islam as a religion. Some people would ask, why do these views deserve airtime? Why is it important to include views of everyone across the country on NPR?
I'll say, and I pressed her even more and raised the point that the majority of mass killings in the United States are carried out by white males. And I said, does that allay your fears at all? And she just said no and didn't believe it. This is really hard, and I've grappled with this for a very long time. So I'll give you the context of what happened and then reflect on it a little bit. So Eileen, after that interview, we aired, in this project, we would profile four voters in a given state, and then they would all watch one of the debates on that evening, and then we would have the four of them come into a studio live the next morning all together and kind of hash out their views and think about what they had seen on the debate the night before. So Eileen came into the studios in Phoenix the next morning with three other voters they hadn't met, and she was carrying this stack of emails and that she had received, and many of them were, you know, some were death threats, some were calling her stupid, hateful, uninformed, and she brought them in and put them on the table and just said, this is what your listeners have been saying to me. She also got so many death threats that her boss in the real estate firm shut down the company and made her move away from her office on the sidewalk because they were worried for her life. I think that in an election, like in 2016, it's our job to understand our country. An election is about voters. It's not just about candidates. It's not just about messages. It's about what you as a voter feel and how that informs your decisions. And I would venture to say that Eileen's view was not rare. This was not someone who was saying some completely crazy, hateful notion that no one else in the country believed. I think it was representative of, you know, a good number of Americans. And that, to me, in an election that we are trying to cover and understand, it's important to listen to one another, even if it's uncomfortable. Now, when someone says something that is, as you said, demonstrably false, it's my job to call them out. I don't think it's my job to hit them in the face with a baseball bat and say you're a racist, but it's my job to call them out and say what the facts are, which I feel like I did. But I would like to think that hearing from Eileen helped us understand our country in an election year and gave people the opportunity to know that these views are out there and gave people the opportunity to look for neighbors or other people who had views that you might find offensive and to try and help them understand things in a different way. And so, and that's kind of what happened that morning. Like, we were in the studio and it didn't all air. Some of it was when the mics were off. And, you know, the three other voters in there, they were angry that she felt this way, but they really tried to talk through with her and help her understand that her views were just not accurate and her fear was not rational to them. So it's a very hard call, and I don't think there's any easy answer. And we never want to be a platform for hate. But when there are times when I truly believe that something is part of a mission to listen to one another, to create a space for people to think out loud and really think deeply about why they believe something and how it's affecting their decision and their politics, like, we've got to do that. I mean, and that can't change because something shocks us or we find something offensive.
One thing you and I have talked about before is NPR, more so in the last year or so, has been doing more live two ways. So that's just a back and forth conversation between a host and a reporter and one other person, sometimes a politician or an expert. But kind of a new strategy the program has been doing is having those conversations and then bringing in a reporter to reflect on what was said. And what did you say that was called?
Well, it's funny you ask, because we called it a level set for a long time. We've changed it to a context set
context
for now.
Set.
Maybe it's going to be a different kind of set. tomorrow.
Something.
So we're experimenting with it.
Okay. So what value do you think that adds, and do you feel like that's been effective in holding someone accountable when you have them live on the radio, just a quick back and forth conversation where essentially they have the opportunity to say whatever they want?
Yeah, I think it. We are, like, it is our job at the end of the day, if someone says something that is false or wrong, to call them out. I have been in cases where someone will say 19 things that are false and wrong, and I actually don't even have time in that segment to call them out for every single one. Mm-hmm. So we had been talking about strategies such as, like, so everything you just said, I actually don't know if any of it's true, and I just want our listeners to know that so we can come back to that later, but please, go on. But when we're on live radio, you have no idea what's going to happen. And we also, we're dealing with 18 subjects, in a given morning, and we have a lot of fantastic correspondents and reporters who follow this stuff all the time. And so, a guest might say something, that is, just to provoke, that's not actually true. They might put something in a context that's not fair. They might throw a charge around suggesting that this is just the accepted narrative, and it's just not. And that might be something that I'm not gonna catch, but that someone like Mara Liasson would, or someone like John Burnett would. And so we felt like it was a way, we want to be careful, because what we don't want to do is to tell you what to think of a conversation you just heard, and I think that can be the danger. It's like, okay, Mara, so what should everyone think about what we just heard? Mm-hmm. We want to avoid that, because you are listening to the radio for a reason. You want to digest and kind of think about things that you hear, and that's so important. But that's why we've kind of been, level set didn't feel right, because it almost felt like someone was saying something that was either too right or too left, and we were going to, like, bring them back, like, into, set the levels back.
Rein them in a little bit.
Right. Yeah. But context felt good, because it's like Mara or Domenico or someone could just say, like, you know what, David, like that, a lot of Republicans have been making that argument. It's not actually true, and we have fact-checked it over and over again. But they're making that argument because polling shows X. And we feel like that's the kind of context that is important to know as, after listening to a conversation. And, it's a way for us to be less terrified of doing conversations like that.
Sure,
like
a little bit of a backup.
If we miss something, like, we can have someone really, really smart and knowledgeable about the subject come in and really kind of look for those moments that need to just be paused on for a moment.
In that same vein of being, like, terrified and calling someone out, another clip I'd like to play, totally different, and to me, this is a type of discomfort that you'll hear it in the clip. And it also approaches a difficult subject, so it's about a sexual assault charge. It's from a 2017 interview with Mike Tyson on his book about his former trainer, and his trainer is somebody that he described as a father. So we'll listen to this one.
Their relationship, though, was complicated. You wrote that you, in order to not disappoint him, you threw yourself into the role of arrogant sociopath. Those are strong words.
You have to look at this, right? I was a smaller guy. I wasn't going to intimidate these fighters. I really went all out on these guys.
But an arrogant...
You understand what I said? I went all out on people. I was arrogant. I looked down on people, the other fighters. I said, no one's going to ever beat me. I'm the greatest fighter in the world.
And so did you like the man he was making you become?
Hey, I like that image of fighting. And it took me a long way.
Tyson is everything that people could have hoped for in that round. There's another big shot by Tyson. Corbett in a heap of trouble. Down he goes.
When Mike Tyson won that first championship back in 1986, Customato was no longer by his side.
And I'd like to dedicate my fight to my great guardian, Customato. And I'm sure he's up there and he's looking and talking to all the great fighters and saying his boy did it.
But after Cuss's death, it seemed like Mike Tyson's life took a turn. There were more boxing victories, of course, but there was also drinking, drugs, and a 1992 rape conviction. And you wonder about some of the lessons his old trainer taught him. As Tyson wrote in his book, quote, Cuss made me feel that hurting people was noble.
When I read that he made you feel like hurting people was noble,
I realized I had to do something that I really didn't want to do because I don't feel like I'd be doing my job if you and I were sitting here and I didn't bring up the rape conviction. Mm-hmm. Was that an instance where you regret how you treated someone?
I didn't never rape that woman. That's just something that I got arrested for, but I ain't never raped that woman.
And I know you've maintained your innocence, but what do you tell people who that's the first thing that comes to mind when they think of Mike Tyson?
I never saw anybody tell me anything, but you. Do you feel you're being a man? Are you being tough telling me that? Or do you feel like you're being a reporter? How you just let me know how do you feel that you do, where you're coming from doing this?
I feel like I'm doing my job. Like I.
This happened 25 years ago, if not more, and you still convicted me?
I'm not convicting you.
Yeah, because you're still bringing it up.
You have the right to answer any way you want. I guess I just, you reflecting on your life, it felt like I had to give you the chance to address this.
Thank you for doing that. And I never did rape that person. They gave me opportunities to just admit that I raped this person and let me go, but I would never do that. I couldn't live with myself doing that.
So in that clip, you say, I realized I had to do something. I don't feel like I'd be doing my job if I didn't, to Mike Tyson. So talk about how, because that was an in-person interview.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he was right there.
Yeah.
In his ring, because we were in his house in Las Vegas.
Yeah. So, I mean, where do you draw that line? Like, where do you feel like, you know, that's a question that had to be asked.
He's bigger than you. Just a little. A little stronger, too. Yeah. If he had not talked about becoming someone who wanted to hurt people, I think it would have been up for a conversation with editors about whether to bring up the rape conviction. I mean, you know, you could talk to Mike Tyson about just his coach and his relationship. I don't know if you have to bring something up every single time you interview a person. But, you know, if it's the one time that Morning Edition listeners are going to hear from Mike Tyson, I mean, I probably still would have erred on the side of at least bring it up and ask him about it. But when you write that you became someone who felt like, you know, it was noble to hurt someone, and this is a person who had been convicted of raping a woman, it was just a no-brainer. Like, if I'm going to allow him to reflect on his life and the man that Customato had turned him into and whether or not that was related, I had to bring it up again. It wasn't fun. There was not a moment when I thought that he would actually hit me, but
he does.
But it's
that.
Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
And he's giving me this dirty look and asking me if I was trying to feel like more of a man. Like I wasn't like feeling good.
No. Yeah. Well, and as a reporter, that's a vulnerable place when someone turns the question around on you.
Right.
You know, that's not something we're really used to.
You should have seen my editor and producer who, I was looking at Mike Tyson here, they were looking at me and the two of them turned and they were just like.
But I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
Towards the end, I mean, you said you wanted to give him the opportunity and he's like, oh, thanks for that. Like his tone changed very quickly. Was that something you noticed in person?
I did, and I couldn't tell if he was being kind of snide or actually being kind of like appreciative. But it was a strange interview. He cried at times during the interview. He seemed surprised when I brought up stuff in a book that I thought that he wrote. There were weird moments. It was surreal, I would say.
I'm sure.
But important, I hope, because it, you know, he's someone that we all know, and the more that I could bring the true Mike Tyson to all of you and to all of us, you know, I think it was important.
Do you remember any feedback following that interview from listeners, or did you ever hear from him or his people?
Did we hear from his people? I think his publicist was not thrilled that we brought that up, if I remember. A lot of the reaction was, are you okay?
Yeah, that's what, yeah, it's uncomfortable. I mean, you can almost just picture, like, what?
Yeah. Because I, you know, there were some lighter moments, and like, you know, we talked about how the Phil Collins song from The Hangover was actually like a song that he loved and that he wanted it played when he came out for one of his first championships, and they played, I think, Toto Africa instead, accidentally. And like The Hangover having the Phil Collins song was like his way of sending a message that that was the song he's always wanted when he knocked out Zach Galifianakis, which was an image that I had in my head when I was sitting there. it was, but you know, I feel like I'm there for all of us, and you know, I need to be there for all of us to learn about someone like that.
Tell us about maybe your most favorite interview you've ever done, or the best experience, like the opposite of Mike Tyson, in a person you've met or a connection you've had during an interview.
That's really tough. I guess I'll mention two. What, because I love interviewing celebrities and people we all know. I think what I like most about it is when I can just treat them like a human being, and I hope that we get to know someone in just a brand new way. But you know, I also love going into communities and trying to understand a place and someone's story and taking all of us to a place where we wouldn't even know about if we didn't go there together. There was a family in North Dakota I interviewed just before the Supreme Court voted to legalize same-sex marriage, and I had been feeling that our coverage of the conversation over same-sex marriage just wasn't deep enough. It had fallen in, I think, to I don't know. We'd done a really good job of celebrating marriages and love stories, which, you know, is like such an important part of that conversation. You know, what is love, and to be able to love whoever you want. And, you know, we'd heard such powerful voices of like love and relationships. We also heard a lot of voices, I think, from people who struggled with same-sex marriage, and a lot of those conversations sort of painted people as, you know, haters or kind of religious zealots. And I just knew that in communities there were much more raw, nuanced conversations happening. And I went to see a family. There was a woman who had written a book about coming out on the North Dakota prairie, where same-sex marriage was still not legal at this time. And I hung out with her, talking to her about her partner, and they were talking about maybe getting married in Minnesota soon. And I hung out with her family, and, you know, I asked her, you know, what it was like to come out to some of her family members. And she said, you know, it had been hard over time, but she had gone through it. And I asked her what her family thinks about the issue of same-sex marriage. And she was like, I don't know, why don't we ask them together? I haven't really talked to them about it. I was like, oh, okay, that sounds like a good opportunity.
Let's do this.
She was like, want to come over for pizza tonight? And I'm like, yeah, we should do pizza. So we all sat around a table, and her mom told the story of remembering when Melanie had come out to her, and she had a sister-in-law there who talked about, you know, loving Melanie and, you know, understanding her more, you know, despite a Catholic upbringing that said that same-sex relationships were wrong. And then I brought up the idea of same-sex marriage, and she got very uncomfortable, and she left the table. And she was kind of standing off in a corner. And her family, including Melanie and everyone else, was kind of saying, like, oh, well, you know, April is, she struggles with this. She, you know, is very active in the Catholic Church. And so she really does, but loves Melanie, doesn't really know what to think about this issue. And April was getting more and more uncomfortable with the fact that we were talking about her. And she just slammed the door of the house and left. And the sound of that slam, like, it has stayed with me since that interview. And we, you know, we talked a lot about whether to put it on the air, whether we had been prying into a family's personal life too much. And it was really Melanie who said, you know, I hope that if more people in the country know that a family is going through something this raw and trying to work through it together, that they'll feel better about being able to have hard conversations together and not avoid them. And there was something really powerful about that. And that family and Melanie's story and April and them opening just their doors to us to serve us pizza and talk about something so personal was really meaningful. On the lighter side, I think singing with Barry Manilow on the air. That was like a dream. That was a producer of... when I do karaoke, Mandy is one of like only two songs that I can even remotely sing well. And I'm talking to Barry Manilow, and I had a producer who was like, you should ask him if you can sing with him. And I was like, are you crazy? Like, and then she kept saying, like, when else are you going to have this chance? And like, she's in my ear, and I was like, okay, Mr. Manilow, can I ask you a weird question? I sing your song, Mandy, in karaoke. Like, would you want to sing a few bars together? He was like, together? I was like, yeah. And he had a piano right there. He starts playing the piano. And so we start singing.
That's awesome.
Mandy. Yeah.
What did he say afterwards? Did he compliment your singing?
Or he did. That? And then I uncomfortably complimented him.
Yeah, you know.
I think he said, like, you hit that note, that wasn't bad. I was like, you weren't bad yourself, Mr. Manilow. And I was like, what did I just say?
I do want to talk about your time in Russia, too, as NPR's Moscow correspondent. So in your book, you talk about how the people in Russia on the street and in public settings can seem very cold.
Mm-hmm.
But when they welcome you into their home, it's the complete opposite. What was that kind of a transition like culturally? And then I'd be interested to know any kind of anecdotes you have from moving to Russia that really stand out.
That makes it very hard because it's a society where you really have to gain trust to be welcomed in. And I think it comes from just, and this is, you know, I don't have firsthand experience with this, but in talking to people, you know, during Soviet times, there was really just this focus on your family and making sure everyone was okay within those walls. And if you were out on the streets, there was always a danger that you could talk to the wrong person, that you could say the wrong thing. And so why risk it by, you know, trying to engage on the street? And so you just had this sort of cold toughness about you. So it made it hard, but it made the reward of having a family trust you and welcome you into like a long night of just eating amazing food and drinking vodka and talking about life all the more special. Russia's a crazy society, and I, for some reason, decided to take the Trans-Siberian Railroad across the entire country, not once but twice. Mm-hmm. It's amazing my wife is still married to me because I think she questioned my sanity. She came on some of the trips, which I think she regrets. there was one time where she met me in Russia, and I had not told her that we were going to be traveling third class on this trip because I wanted to like experience real Russia. And when we had been on Russian trains before, we had at least done second class where you get like a compartment. This was like a dorm room. And we got on the train and it was all young men who were coming from Central Asia to look for construction work and then me and my wife. And so she was like the only woman on the train. We board and they're like making all of these like really offensive gestures at her. And she's just like, do you see what you've done? And she took out her iPhone and started recording a video. And she addressed it to our future children. And she said that if you're getting this message, that means you were born. And so your father did survive this night. But that this is what he had subjected me to in Russia on a cold, snowy night. I learned a lot. I think I made a lot of assumptions about Russia growing up, you know, and I was growing up during the fall of the Soviet Union and just assumed that as soon as the Soviet Union fell, countries like Russia would just want to have our style of democracy. And in talking to Russians, really well-traveled, you know, people who followed the news closely, so this was not a matter of not being informed. You know, a lot of Russians don't like our style of democracy. They don't feel like it's something they necessarily want. And I think they're exploring what they do want. And it's a long, long road. And I think the hard thing is that people like Vladimir Putin, I think, can really take advantage of that. And, you know, if you're a leader like he is, he can say, well, my country's not ready for democracy yet. And, I mean, that could be true in the sense that there are a lot of Russians who don't necessarily want American democracy. So that plays well politically at home. But it also gives him the opening to, you know, violate human rights, to, you know, continue to run most of the media in Russia. So it's really dangerous. And so there's almost, I mean, there's almost two sides of Russia. There's like the leadership, there's Putin, there are the oligarchs, there's, you know, Putin's frightening sort of effort to expand Russian influence now, including in our elections and in foreign policy. But then there's the Russian people who I think are not the only society today trying to really figure out, you know, their next steps in their journey and what kind of government they want. And I think we as Americans just need to accept that while we have ideals that are so important, and, you know, I'd like to believe that our style of democracy is something that I have real faith in and believe in, and I'm proud to be a citizen in, it is not something that everyone in this world wants. They want something different, potentially, and that's okay.
And what insight do you feel like being the correspondent over there and living and interacting with Russian people kind of gives you insight and thoughts into the overarching question of Russia's influence on our democracy?
They're scary. And it's, I think in the same way that I'm giving in a kind of opening to people who want to think about different systems of government, you know, I would also like to believe that we as a country and our system can set an example for the world. And I think what Vladimir Putin often looks for is chaos and disorder that can cause people to doubt democracy. And I'm not drawing a perfect line here between the Russians' involvement in our election and the eroding faith in our democracy. But whatever is happening in our country right now when it comes to a lack of trust in institutions, when it comes to a lack of trust in the media, there's something very frightening. And I think it benefits people and leaders like Vladimir Putin who don't want democracy to look neat. They want democracy to look messy, so you question it. And when democracy is messy and when there's disorder, people in the world look to, you know, to very, you know, very paternalistic leaders and autocratic leaders. And you look around the world right now and, you know, you look at places like the Philippines, and Duterte has, you know, like a 90%+ approval rating, and he is someone who has just cracked down and, you know, gone on a murderous campaign, you know, carrying this flag of I'm fighting drugs and I'm fighting crime. And, you know, Vladimir Putin, I think, has taken advantage of Russian citizens, not to the extent that a lot of people believe. I think a lot of Russian voters have, you know, do stick up for themselves and have views about what they want that they express. They're not just victims in some game by Vladimir Putin. But his goal is to make democracy look messy. And the more that he can do that, and the more that we as the United States lets him get away with that and lets leaders like him get away with that, I think the world becomes more dangerous.
I saw a picture, it was on Twitter today, and a fellow journalist had shared it, and it was of a little boy holding a sign, and it said, first they came for the journalists, and it said, we don't know what happens next, or what happened next. And that really, that hit me really hard.
That's really powerful.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't know if that little boy wrote that. I'm like, he's deep. Like,
pretty
he's
deep.
Gonna,
yeah.
He's wise beyond his years, but...
That's really powerful.
And that to me, tracks with what you're saying, with creating something that's messy. And I feel like if the media is portrayed as messy and fake, it kind of creates the same possibilities of an end.
And elections.
Yeah.
I mean, if we start not having faith in our elections and not having faith in there being an impartial media, you know, democracy starts looking messy.
Where do you see things going in terms of our relationship with Russia? Do you see this mellowing out anytime soon? Do you see any insights you could share just from being there? The Mueller report is supposed to be released this week.
Yeah, something's
supposed to happen.
A small story next week.
Yeah.
it is really hard to say. I mean, Donald Trump has upended sort of the traditional norms of U.S. foreign policy, to say the least. And I think that there are arguments, that people will make that this has been, a long time in the making. People will make the argument that the UN is a meaningless organization. People will make the argument that the United States has carried too much of the burden on NATO. Like, there are a lot of people who agree with what he's doing. So when I say upend, I'm not saying it necessarily in a negative way, because there are a lot of people in foreign policy who do like it. But I don't think anyone doubts, his supporters or detractors or anywhere in between, that he has, upended the norms of American foreign policy and diplomacy. And so where it goes is really, really unpredictable. What Trump has done in Israel raises a lot of questions about, whether this has the makings of real conflict. His relationship with Netanyahu is something that, pleases a lot of people, but it has the potential, to really cause conflict in the world if the Palestinians feel more and more threatened. And then when it comes to Putin, it's just a total wild card. There are things that the Trump administration has done that have been very tough on Russia. But there have also been signals, and we don't know what goes on behind the scenes, because he won't even have an interpreter in there or who's allowed to talk. But what signals Vladimir Putin has taken in terms of an opening to, really spread Russian influence in the Middle East, in places like Syria, and to take ownership of different places in the world where the United States really had, ambitions and influence. It's kind of a wild card.
So this has all been very heavy. So I have an idea for something fun to close things out before we go to audience questions. So be thinking of your questions, but I think some of them will be answered here, because I have a lightning round that I've put together for things that I know you have always wanted to know about David Green. So in each of our cups, we have pieces of paper.
Wait, don't I get to ask you things, too?
Yes.
These are things everyone always wants to know about Abigail. This is good.
Well, maybe like my mom right here. So, and in sitting here, I realized I didn't plan this out very well. Our cups have the same questions.
So we might answer the same question?
So if you get a duplicate, just put it on the side.
Okay.
So I'll start. I'll ask you one. You have to answer like as fast as you can, and then you'll ask.
And I get to ask.
Yeah. Okay.
Excellent.
All right. What is the last thing that you watched on YouTube?
Wow. It's really sad. Someone had put up the Glenn Greenwald interview with the audio plays, and it's Glenn Greenwald with me, who looks like a weird cartoon character of like a crying dragon.
Oh no. Okay.
Yeah. I want to watch something else now.
Yeah, you should revise that.
Yeah. That'd be great. Okay. What is your most unusual talent?
Well, as my coworkers can attest to today, I'm really good at parallel parking.
Really?
Yeah, I really am.
Do you ever have to try twice, or you nail it on the first time?
Usually first time, yeah.
Wow. Like in small spaces?
Yeah, I think so.
Should teach a class.
Yeah, I should. Maybe that'll be my... And then, so in preparation for this, I asked my husband, do I have a talent? And he said that I'm really good at marinating chicken. So...
What makes one good at marinating chicken?
Hey, it's a secret talent.
Is it the marinade or is it the
I put vinegar
execution?
In there. Oil and vinegar and then your seasonings, and I think that's the trick.
Okay.
So
it's the recipe as much
I guess.
As the actual...
Yeah.
Okay, that's all. That's good talent.
What is the most awkward thing that happens to you on a regular basis?
I get very loud at sports bars.
Okay.
And I don't realize how loud I'm being.
So you're like, people are looking at you.
I'm very angry about what's happening to my teams generally. And sometimes my wife will have to put her hand over my mouth and kind of sit me down and remind me that I'm in public.
Does anybody ever, like, recognize you or your voice?
Thankfully not.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I'm glad you're getting this one. Any figure, past or present, who you would like to interview? Oh, any figure, past or present, who would you interview?
I wish I had something, like, very profound.
Less profound is more fun.
I really and truly, I would love to have been able to speak to Shel Silverstein.
That's profound. Yeah.
Because that's when I think of growing up and reading, and what really started my love for creative writing was those books. I mean, I would flip through them, and I can picture the covers. And you know, he was kind of a goofy looking guy, and I just somebody that I feel like I know from my childhood, and that would have been interesting.
That's a good. That's so, really
thanks.
Yeah.
What was your first job?
Shopping carts at Giant in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
How old?
In like 98 degree heat.
Great.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I finally got inside and worked in produce in the cold. I went from hot to cold, which was great.
And produce was preferred.
Produce was definitely preferred, but the carts. Like I like interacting with people out in the like in the parking lot, like collecting the carts, and also it was. I like judging people was fun too.
Like, oh, you bought lots of junk food.
Well, like you'd like see people and be like, the rack is right there. Like, so, do you need to let go of the cart and let it literally like roll down the entire length of the parking lot so I have to walk down there and pick it up? Like, it's right there.
Yeah.
Like, just throw me a bone and put the cart somewhere close.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the people who would like friendly, like put it in the thing, ask if I'd like, you know, they wanted me to add it to the line or anything. Uh-huh. It was like good people.
Yeah. It was a pretty good judge of someone's character, yes. What they do with their cart.
It's one of those things, yeah.
I think.
Yeah, there are people who put the cart in the little cart area, and there are people who don't. And yes. Those are two different people in the world. Yeah. Okay, that's not going to ask you about YouTube, although I'm kind of curious, but. Okay, I'm not going to ask you.
Sorry.
About
See, I should have thought this out better.
No.
I should have played beforehand.
When you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up, and what do you want to be now? I like the two. I like the
Thanks.
Two-parter.
I went through a lot of different phases of what I wanted to be when I was little. My mom likes to tell this story. I used to tell her I was going to be the president, and then she could come live at the White House and take care of my babies. And now I can't imagine a job that I would like less than to be the president. I love my job now, and I love radio and working in Morning Edition. I think this is not real, but the concept of being like a stay-at-home astronaut is something that I would like to pursue and make into.
So like at the International Space Station?
No, like, be an astronaut, wear the suit, do the things, but be at my house.
Oh.
You know, like, I could have the training, but I could still be, like, in my bed.
What about, like, quick trips?
Yeah, like if
orbit,
they could do it fast.
And then back home for...
At first, I thought you meant go to, like, Quick Trip, the gas station. I'm like, I want to be a Quick Trip astronaut.
I wonder if anyone in the world has ever said stay-at-home astronaut.
I've been thinking. It's what I think about when I marinate chicken. Okay, we've got all these. There should be. Okay.
I think that's the name of your memoir.
Yeah, that should be. Stay-at-home astronaut.
Who marinates chicken.
So this can probably be maybe one more each, and then we'll go to audience questions. What is a food that you like that most people would find revolting?
Permani Brothers sandwich. Does anyone know that?
I don't know.
This is a Pittsburgh delicacy. You take two thick slices of bread, you put meat, and my favorite is double kobasi, which is double kobasi meat, and then you literally stack everything on top of it, including French fries, including all sorts of like toppings. You douse it in Tabasco sauce, and the thing becomes like a tower, and then you eat it.
All of it?
All of it.
Okay. Wow, yeah, I'll have to, I can't even visualize.
And my record is 3 in 1 day. And it was on a reporting trip, because I took a colleague of mine who had never been to Pittsburgh, we got one for breakfast. And then we're interviewing this guy, and he said, come meet me at Permane's in Mars, Pennsylvania. And I was like, yes. And so he wanted to show me his favorite new Permane Brothers, which was this like new Angus steak Permane. And then we were interviewing people at a hockey game that night. And of course, if you go to a Pittsburgh hockey game, you have to eat Permane. So,
were you sick?
Very.
Yeah, I would think so. Good. Okay.
Yeah. Very. Okay. There was. I do kind of want to hear them now.
You can ask. I mean.
Really?
We might be out.
You know what? I'm going to ask this one.
Okay.
What is a food you like that most people would find revolting?
That's a novel question. I'm original. Chicken. I always knew when my dad made my lunch when I was little because we would get a peanut butter mayonnaise and pickle sandwich. And they're delicious. It's really, I mean, yeah, no, it's good. And it, like, people, I would pull it out and people would be like, ugh. Because it kind of smells, you know, there's aren't smells that you mix often.
Does the mayonnaise and peanut butter, like, do you mix them?
No, it's like one on each side and then you do the sliced pickles in the middle.
I am actually going to give this a chance. I'm going to taste this.
Yeah, so.
One time.
Okay.
This is. Did you invent this?
Yeah.
Really? I would, if you make it, I'm eating it.
Yeah, so that's it. So, well, now that we're all friends and know all these things about each other, we do have some microphones. I can't really see. Or what is the... Kyle will come up and we'll do some audience questions. So we do have about a half an hour, but let's try to keep them short and sweet for everybody. And we have some microphones. So,
just make an orderly line, please, behind this microphone in the center aisle here. And please keep your questions pretty short because we've got running low on time here. So,
as a fellow journalist, how do you view Julian Assange and his arrest?
Thank you for that.
And Wayne works for the Gazette here, so he's a reporter here in Colorado Springs, too. So.
You know, I've had an opportunity to think a lot about it, his arrest the last couple of days. Yeah, it's really... So the charge that the U.S. government has actually now filed suggesting that he actively tried to help Chelsea Manning crack into U.S. classified documents, that has really stuck with me as an important distinction. And even Glenn Greenwald like said that if it is true that Julian Assange, you know, cracked himself into U.S. classified information like that, it's hard to argue that that's not breaking the law. Even if you argue that you are doing it in the interest of press freedom and holding a government accountable. Like, I would like to believe that if I did that, I would have to acknowledge that I broke the law and that it's not something that is protected or easily protected under the First Amendment.
Bedrock principle, no one's above the law.
Yeah. You know, short of that, it a lot of what I reflected on with the document releases was... if you're just releasing raw information, are you a journalist? You know, and I would like to believe that the stories that we read that were based on those documents were done by reporters who, you know, who were experts in the field and experts on their beats. And I would, you know, this gets to what I was talking about, like the importance of journalism today. You know, it's not to lecture people, it's not to tell you what to think, but if an expertise isn't important, if a beat isn't important, if a reporter taking raw facts and either writing about it or putting a segment on the air, if that's not important work, then what are we all doing here? So I make a distinction between that kind of work, like what the New York Times and other organizations would do based on what was released by WikiLeaks, and then just a raw document dump. So I see those as two different definitions. You know, I also reflect on the importance of holding a government accountable. I mean, and we know that governments will keep more secrets than they need to. And that's not right. And so I know I hope it doesn't sound like I'm evading, but it's these are a lot of the things that I've been thinking about and that I think will be really important in shaping our coverage, you know, if indeed he's extradited and if indeed he, you know, he has his day in a U.S. court. It is, I mean, as you know, this is a really polarizing person and a really polarizing story, and it's going to be incumbent on us to explore different facets of this and ask, you know, the big questions in a very fair way, and it's a hard one.
I do feel conflicted.
That makes me happy. We can commiserate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you call him a journalist?
I struggle with that. I struggle with the same definition that you say is just doing a document dump, making a journalist. And the fact that there were some fake documents mixed among real ones in the Democrat. Documents that were hacked from the Democrats makes me wonder whether he's more of a propagandist than a journalist. I'm very conflicted about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne.
Well, health care is an important issue in our country, I think, these days. And I know that the health care market is strongly, market forces are strongly dominated by insurance companies. I think they're the most powerful part of that market. And I wonder why almost all of the feature stories on NPR about healthcare are produced by the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Do you mean Kaiser Health News?
Well, yeah, they're produced by the Kaiser Family Foundation, and they... You know, it feels like advertising to me.
So this is where I'm going to have to plead some ignorance. I truly believe in the place where I work. And we, you know, for example, Julie Rovner covered healthcare policy at NPR for years and is now working at Kaiser Health News. I truly do not believe that we would use content from Kaiser Health News if we thought there was an ounce of a chance that the pharmaceutical industry was guiding that coverage in any way, shape, or form. And if I ever learned that there was any crack in that, I would be deeply alarmed and deeply disappointed. And so I have enormous faith in our editors and our news executives to really scrutinize that. I acknowledge that, you know, if you follow the money, you know, and this is an issue that has come up in this day and age, and we have foundations. We have the Gates Foundation we take a lot of money from. And, you know, do foundations have agendas? Of course they do. Are foundations integral in providing funding and support for us to do incredibly important journalism? Absolutely. Do we have to create a firewall to make sure that we're not making editorial decisions based on a foundation's agenda? Absolutely. Do we have to disclose when we're reporting on an organization or a foundation that we receive money from? We do it every time, and we get screamed at by our managing editor for ethics if we don't. So it's not a neat and tidy situation. All I can say is I really believe in my employer, and if I didn't, you know, I wouldn't be working there, because that is so central to our credibility, being really transparent about that and never allowing you know, our coverage to be guided in that way.
Well, I just I want to say that I really believe in NPR as well, and I am a therapist, and I have watched people become more and more upset with all the things that are going on, and I often tell them that as an antidote to the horrible news that they get on cable streaming, they really need to listen to NPR and get a balanced picture, a variety of stories that hit many, many different kinds of topics. And I think it really helps people to kind of calm down a little bit. And so I want you to know that I really also believe in NPR, but this is something that has just troubled me for a while, and it feels like there's a bias.
Well, and I don't blame you for asking, and I think we need you to hold our feet to the fire on those issues, because there's a lot of money flying around, and we do have to be enormously careful, and I really believe that we are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So my question is more related to journalism as a whole. With the growth of a lot of authoritarian regimes in the world, frequently journalists are targeted for harassment or even violence. What can ordinary informed citizens do to try to make the world a safer place for journalists to bring us the stories that need to be told?
I think it's a really good question. I think that you can consider giving money to and supporting organizations that look out for journalists, which I think are really crucial. I think you can help raise awareness. I honestly think, and it's not that I'm saying it's all about the United States, but the more that we can send a message that the kind of journalism and press freedoms in our country are important, the more that sets an example and puts pressure, I hope, on regimes and other leaders in the world. And I say that because, it's kind of what we were talking about. Like, I'm deeply alarmed now that even in our country, where the First Amendment is so sacred and where press freedom, I thought, was so sacred, and where a belief in the institution of the media that we're at least trying to do what's right is so sacred. And a lot of that, frighteningly feels to be eroding right now. And the more that I think our country questions the credibility of the media, the less need people will feel in other countries to fight for those kinds of press freedoms there. Because this is an area where I really do believe that we should set an example for the world in terms of the importance of this profession. And so the more that you can teach people, the more that you can, if you're a teacher or you're interacting with younger people, to teach them about what journalism is all about and what news is and why it's important to have trusted sources and why it's important to do the kind of work that we do, I feel like, you're fighting important battles in that larger war.
Hey, David. My name's David, too.
Good name. There are a lot of us.
Yeah. So as someone who graduated with a bachelor's in journalism from a top institution, I'm not working in the field currently, but I'm working in marketing advertising, kind of not necessarily parallel, but I can apply my skills there. There's a market decision. Seeing the rise of technology and how that's shaping the media landscape, how do you view the future of journalism? Is it always going to be driven and generated by people with heartbeats and blood flowing through our brains? Or is it going to be an AI-dominated thing? And are we going to be relevant when it comes to producing content going forward?
I'll say a couple of things.
Northwestern.
It's a great school. There have been moments when I thought it was the end of the world for journalism before. When I came to NPR, one of the first sessions we had was with a researcher who had polled college students, and there was something like there was one class of 29 students and not one of them owned a radio. And I was like, it's a great time to get into radio. This is perfect. But I just think about today, and I think about, you know, everyone, but especially younger people. They are appreciating, you know, sound as storytelling and the experience in ways that I've never seen before. You know, and it's, you know, you can stream stations on different devices. You can listen on your smart speaker. I mean, there just doesn't have to be a radio. It can be podcasts. But the experience that a lot of people are craving right now in terms of an audio experience and in terms of a rich storytelling experience, you know, it's like nothing I've seen. And a lot of the lessons I learned coming into radio 14 years ago, I mean, even though technology has totally changed, even though the platforms have changed, like, I'm still using those lessons today. And that gives me, you know, that gives me a lot of hope. You know, things are changing. You know, I was talking about this earlier. Like, one of the things that we're doing now at Morning Edition is we create a 12 to 14 minute podcast every day called Up First. And we've worked so closely with stations, because what we don't want to do is say to listeners, you know, hey, here's a way that you don't have to listen to your station. You can get what you need here. Because that's like the opposite of what we all want. So we've found ways to really brand Up First as something that is, A, because of, you know, all of you supporting a station in your community, and it truly is, because the way that we can actually create something like that comes from your support. You know, it just comes up to us. And also that we're trying to use as an opportunity to draw in younger people and say, like, hey, you like this experience, like this 12 to 14 minutes of us discussing the news and hopefully you developing a relationship with us as hosts and developing that trust in the NPR brand, then hopefully you're going to understand how much you need that, and you're going to be active, you know, in your station community, and you're going to support. So it's trying new things, and I've been so gratified that podcast has the youngest audience of any podcast, you know, at NPR, which means that younger people are craving, you know, storytelling, rich storytelling, different experiences, other stuff, but like they're craving news. And so the demand for news is still there. I think the demand for services like that we provide, which, you know, I hope are trusted news organizations and trusted brands, that demand is still there. And so I'm more optimistic, I think, than I've been in a long time. Even though it's chaotic, the environment is crazy, the definition of news, we're losing it. Like, there's some pretty horrifying things that we need to deal with. But all in all, like, I feel pretty good and hopeful. And I just hope I have good reason to be. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for being here, for your continued work.
Thanks for having me.
This might dovetail well into your last answer, because I've found a bit of overload. Even NPR, even Morning Edition, can sometimes feel like Trump's tweets of the day. And that's just what you lead with, and that's what it is. And I found myself switching over to the radio, BBC Radio World Service, that they also stream here. And so I'm just wondering what the newsroom or the editorial room, what sort of conversations do you all have on when you choose to go down those rabbit holes or when you choose not to follow other media outlets?
It's a really good question. And some of the conversations are, do we really need to cover this tweet? And we have those conversations all the time. And have, you know, I covered the White House for 8 years, and I try to look back to the editorial decisions we made then when, for example, if the president released a statement that was emailed out, would we automatically jump on it and do a 4-minute segment about a statement? No. And so I think a lot of the conversations we have are, you know, is this just the president, you know, just saying something to provoke? Is it newsworthy? Is it important? Could what he just said in this tweet, you know, change the conversation in some way? Does it move the actual news, or is it just him saying something to draw attention? And so those are some of the conversations we're having. And I'll also say, you are so not alone. I don't get to see all of this, but I know in some of our audience data, you know, over the last 6 to 12 months, you know, we have a lot of very loyal listeners who have said, like, I just feel like there's a flood of water, like, in my face. Like, can you please just, like, I want the news, it's important, but just, like, sometimes, just, like, I don't need one thing after another, after another, after another. So I hope you're hearing a difference on our show, because our executive producer is she's amazing. Her name's Kenya Young, and she is really committed to finding a balance. And one thing she's done, you know, we have, our segments are lettered. Our A segment is the segment at the top of the hour. Our C segment is what you hear, you know, at like the half hour. Our top segment is like 11 minutes long now. You know, sometimes she wants like the last 2 or 3 minutes to just be something fun or cute or interesting or a slice of life. I think that's so important. The segment that comes in between those two, I mean, she believes so passionately that that should not, unless it's just a crazy news morning, that should be something that is just more step back, more reflective, that takes us to a different place than those other segments. This morning, it was a 7-minute conversation I had with an Associated Press reporter who followed the only body recovery specialist in Mozambique in the wake of the cyclone. And I was just riveted. I mean, she's a young reporter, an amazing writer, who just made this unbelievable decision. I'm going to cover this story by following one person. And it was one of the best stories I've ever read in the wake of a natural disaster. I hope you're going to hear as much of that as you do, you know, something rounding up the day's politics. So we're trying, and we're really striving to find that balance, to cover the news that is important, to keep you feeling like you can listen to us and feel like you're on top of what's happening in the country and the world, but also have a chance to breathe.
My name is Rick, and yes, we listen to you every day.
Thank you.
The question I have is related to your time in Moscow. 55 years ago or so, I was in an intensive Russian course while I was in the Air Force, and we had all native-born Russian teachers. And there was one woman who was, I don't know, 5 feet tall and 5 feet around, and we called her Mama Petrichenko, and she was a wonderful woman, and she defended Russia almost to the death. And she treated us as a group of Air Force people that were going to get Mother Russia back. We were free to badmouth the Soviet Union all we wanted, but we couldn't say bad things about Russia. And in the environment that we're in today, hate is one of those words that can be thrown around a lot. When you were in Moscow, did you have a sense of an attitude among the Russians, and I don't even know what level of society this would maybe apply to, and their opinion of Americans versus our government? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. It is different, I think. I think that a lot of Russians, and I hate to glom all Russians together, but the impression I would often get, especially in this day, and especially among people who lived through Soviet times, is they remember that even in the hardest times in Soviet days, they felt a sense of pride, and they felt a sense of purpose. And that was... that taught me a lot that I don't think I knew when I was growing up and thought that Soviet citizens just probably all hated us. And that was just not the case. And I think that there was a curiosity there, there was some longing, but there was also, like, it wasn't a hatred of America, it was a real sense of Soviet pride. And a lot of Russians today who live through that, I think, feel an emptiness. And even Russians who like Vladimir Putin don't feel the same sense of pride they did in Soviet times. And so when it comes to, like, the U.S. government, and I haven't been there recently, so I don't know about the Trump era, but there was some admiration, like feeling like the U.S. government was a government that still made people in the United States feel proud of something and proud of an ideal. And I found a lot of Russians who were left longing a little bit and wanted to feel, I think, the sense of pride in Mother Russia that you felt from her. When it comes to Americans, Moscow's kind of a different place. I mean, there's a lot of money there. There's a lot of ego there. There are a lot of people who have way too much money and are spending time shopping for fancy Italian clothing and boutiques that are just ridiculously expensive. It's sort of an annoying city. It's fun. It's alive. But you experience what I think is real Russia when you get outside of Moscow. And there, almost without fail, once you would develop that trust, I think the most powerful feeling I got was curiosity. And it was curiosity with a real open mind. And it was kind of lovely. Because, I had so many conversations where I would be doing the interview, but I would get as many questions as I was asking.
Were you speaking Russian, or did you have a translator?
No, and that's that. And actually, I wrote about this in my book. I still, to this day, regret not learning more Russian. I never got to a place of conversation. I took 3 months of intensive, and then I was just like thrown into story after story, which, I don't regret that. But, I was really honest. I mean, there's NPR's producer in Moscow, Sergei Sotnikov, is became a dear friend of mine. And so I almost saw Russia through his eyes, which was good in one sense because he's Russian. And I think he could see his country in a way that I never could. But I think I missed, not having the language myself, I missed a lot of the nuance. And, a lot of things just can't be translated, even with the best translator interpreter. Just the nuance of someone's sense of humor or a turn of phrase. It's, you miss things. And I had, I come by that cleanly, that was held me back.
We wondered, those of us that were students there, there was a speech that Khrushchev made, I think in Iowa, when he said, we just want peace. Well, it may have been humor, because the Russian word for the world is the same as the Russian word for peace.
Yes.
And we kind of wondered about that. Thank you.
That's a good one. I like that. Thank you very much.
This is just kind of a funny coincidence. Until he mentioned it, I didn't realize he's a former Air Force Russian linguist. I'm actually a retired Air Force Korean linguist, so just a coincidence. But I did want to say, in my 20 years of military service, protecting the nation from foreign countries and adversaries and such, serving to protect our democracy and our nation from the foreign threat, of course, the other very important aspect of protecting our nation democracy is a free press. So I just want to say that everything that you, Ms. Beckman, and the gentleman from the Gazette do is very, very important and very much appreciated. And so I would urge you to ignore the trolls and keep up the good work, because it's very, very important. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can't top that one. That was great. But I'm going to put you on the spot, I think.
Oh, boy.
Yes. We've heard throughout this presidency the term alternative facts. Why don't we simply call a lie a lie? Just a question.
So I wish, be a lot better if I could find very quickly our managing editor for Ethics, long, long statement about this. So different news organizations have different opinions about that word. It is not my decision. The guidance that we have gotten is that saying something is not true, saying something is wrong, saying something has no basis on fact, is not based on fact, is different from the word lie, because lie is a motivation. And you cannot get into the head of someone else unless you talk to them and they tell you about why they have said something. And that distinction, if we are truly, truly doing our jobs to say that someone just lied and said this, is to get into their motivation. And our guidance from our editorial leadership has been that we should aggressively call out things that are not true, and can't do that enough. And I could not agree more. And I think, you know, I'll stand by the extent to which we've done that. I mean, I feel like we've done some of the most cutting-edge coverage in terms of State of the Union speeches and in terms of political debates literally in the moment, calling things out when they're not true and providing the truth and providing context. But the lie one is hard, and that's the guidance that we live by, and you know, that's the distinction that I think our editorial team has made.
I understand, and I think you've done a really good job. The problem, I guess, I have is the word fact. Truth, reality, or some strange dream that we're living.
Oh, I think when you hear things like fake news and alternative facts, it feels like a pretty weird dream. And a scary one.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, thank because those shouldn't exist.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for the question.
So I'll follow up just a little bit with her question. I'm a high school English teacher. I'm actually teaching 1984 right now.
You're going to tell me I have the definition of lie wrong, aren't
you? I know. I'm an avid NPR listener. In fact, my son does some work, and my favorite day was when David Greene got to interview him. He was down on the border in Mexico, James Frederick. So James works and loves you, and so excited I'm here tonight.
Oh, my God, that's fantastic.
I know, isn't that fun?
Hi. Yeah, that's really lovely.
I know, so I'll have to, so it's kind of fun. But anyway, I listen to NPR all the time, and I share it with my students at school. But what advice would you give young people, it's actually their assignment for next week, to discern fact? How do they today, and I have a lot of hope in our world teaching high school seniors, but what advice would you give them for what to believe, whether they're listening to NPR or CNN or Fox News? How do they discern truth anymore?
I mean, I think one thing that's important is, as you listen to something, is it something that can be proven? A hurricane hit Ecuador yesterday. It's like, okay, that's, you know, you don't, depending on the source, you don't have to believe it, but that is a thing that you could go check out and report on. I mean, it's based on, you know, if true, it's based on facts. There was a storm. There was a weather system. It hit a country. I mean, there's presumably damage. How much damage? How much are people rebuilding in pain? You know, were people hurt? You know, that's news. That's fact. You know, there was a presidential tweet at one morning that basically said, like, I am putting new sanctions on Iran, and these are the best and biggest sanctions that have ever been put on that country.
Right.
I mean, I'm paraphrasing, so I mean, I'm not quoting. Sure. But it's like, okay, that is something that, like, okay, what makes them the best? Mm-hmm. And what makes them the biggest? And then you start thinking, like, okay, was that a fact? And how do you check it? Like, best is certainly up for interpretation. Biggest, okay, in theory, you could, like, start looking at different sanctions regimes against Iran, but they deal with different sectors of the economy, and is one bigger because it's dealing with a more important sector? Like, what is, suddenly you're like, that, don't take that as fact. And that was actually one morning, you know, the whole question of covering tweets came up when I actually had a really last-minute conversation with some editors. I was like, We are not saying this. I am not reading this president's tweet for something that, like, we don't know anything about its validity. And if this is important, if there's really a new sanctions regime, then let's start calling people in the region or call Peter Kenyon and talk about what it means and what's actually happening. So I think that is an important distinction to me, and that it's getting back to basics. And it makes me sad that we have to do that. But in this world, you know, I would love to think that your students, you know, if we get them back to basics and we get them back to, like, what is news, and you hear something and it's like, okay, that's a thing. It did or did not happen. Like, I can check that. Or is that just something that someone said and there's actually no way to even know? That's not news. I think we'll be getting closer to the right path again.
We hope so. Well, thank you. Thanks for being
thank
here.
You for doing what you do.
I know it's 9 o'clock, so I'm just going to make this quick. I just had to respond to that clip that you played with the lady from Arizona, because I am a Mormon, and I just want to say that we don't all think like that. And when I heard that clip, I was seriously offended, and I was angry at her. And then you said the next day she brought in the hate mail, and I felt for her. And I was offended that people would treat her that way. And I just want to compliment you on... I think that's what NPR does that's so wonderful, is showing us the humanity and opening our minds. And even though I was mad at her, I felt for her at the same time. And so my question is, I guess since you guys are, you're just so good at doing that and being objective and finding the humanity, what is your advice to us as normal people to be able to do that better, and especially in this time that we're living in?
I mean, I'm not one to give advice beyond what I do, but my hope, like, is that you know, and she's obviously in Arizona, but that you might find it in yourself to take that to the next step. That, I mean, it's not just something you hear on the air, but if someone says something that really makes you angry, you know, and you can't do this every time, but, like, really makes you angry, it's like, be angry, but then immediately see that humanity, and beyond that, like, make it an opening. Like, make it an opening to sit down and just say, like, you know, can we respectfully talk about why you just made me really mad? Because I want you to understand why that makes me mad, but I also want to understand your fear. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, like, and this is, you know, I don't want to get all schmaltzy, but it's like a lot of the emotions that we're all feeling are the same emotions. Like, you look at some of these really polarizing debates, and a lot of them just come down to fear. I mean, a lot of what this president is playing on is fear, but a lot of what people who hate him are feeling is fear. And, you know, a lot of people are afraid right now. They might be afraid of him. You know, a lot of Trump supporters are afraid of things that he is saying he can fit. Like, there's a lot of shared human emotion. And, you know, I'll finish by saying this. When we were covering some of the deaths at the hands of police, young African Americans, I mean, over the past 4 or 5 years, I spoke to a woman named Connie Rice. She's a civil rights attorney in Los Angeles, and she was really tough on LAPD for years. I mean, during the Rodney King days, would hold their feet to the fire, filed one civil rights lawsuit after another, but she's come around to now work with LAPD and work with police officers in general. And I was asking her, like, what kind of conversations do you have with police? And she said, you know, she's not going to talk specific cases, but that one common theme is that a police officer, often a white male, will come to her and say, Connie, I am afraid of black men, and I feel terrible about it. Can you please help me overcome that, because I don't want to be that way? And I immediately said to her, I was like, so a police officer who says that, like, isn't that racism? And what she said to me was that, you know, people have to judge that on their own, but that she sees it as her job to be able to find places where people can put the shoes of someone else on. You know, that a white cop can figure out what it might be like for a young black teenager to be in a neighborhood where they don't trust the police, but that, like, maybe some people can understand, you know, someone who feels a fear that they don't want to feel and that they're trying to overcome it. And you know what? Like, for someone to hear that, I can't put myself in the shoes of someone who's African-American who hears a white cop say, "I'm afraid of black men." Like, if you want to believe that's racism and hate that person, like, I am sure as heck not going to stop you because, you know, that's just not my role, and I don't understand what it's like to hear that. You know, but the more when there are moments when someone is willing to create a space to say, like, I feel this way, this is why, but is giving you the opening to actually talk about it, you know, maybe there are times when you can have that conversation, and maybe there are times when you can't. You know, maybe there are times when you're so angry and find something so hateful that you hear that there's just, you don't think that the person deserves to have a conversation. That's fine. But the more those conversations can happen and the more that we can look for those moments, you know, I think we're going to be a better country for it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, well, that concludes our evening for this evening, so thank you all for coming out. Let's thank our guests again tonight. Thank you all. Safe travels home tonight. All right.